Now it is my privilege to introduce tonight's speaker, so please offer a Warren Valley Group welcome to Dave from Visalia. David.
Hi,
Dave.
I did it.
You did it.
Sorry.
My name is David. I'm an alcoholic. But to welcome the newcomers, I hope that that you give yourself a break and that you take advantage of the opportunity to change your life, to allow the program, the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the Fellowship in God to change your life. It takes a lot. It takes a lot to get sober and, more importantly, to stay sober. I got here in on October 2nd of 1989. I had attempted recovery 10 years prior to that in the same building that I wound up in 1989. I had gone into Pine and stayed there for about 15 days and got healthy enough, had a few meals, and decided that I was in control again, and left in 1980. And continued my journey. 1986, I once again was in the throes of the disease, and, well, I was 30 days after I left Pine the first time. But it lasted until 86 when, through family and others, intervention happened, and I wound up going to another recovery center, Teen Challenge in Shafter, where I stayed for 6 months, and once again decided that I could exit the program a little bit early because I had important things to do, and got drunk again, and in 1989, I finally became willing to do what this program asked me to do. A little bit about my history. I was raised in a dysfunctional situation. Parents were, you'll hear me refer to my father, that's my father, the one that fathered me, and my dad, the one that raised me. And everybody in my house was drunk, and they always were, and we moved all the time. And I always, even before I drank, before, you know, in my adolescent years, felt different, felt less than, never quite adequate, never having a connection with people, because we moved 26 times in 8 years, here, there, and everywhere. And so I never connected with anybody and learned not to. And it was and still is, to some degree, a defect of character of mine, not being social. And it just is. But much better than it used to be. So we did that, and I left home when my parents were moving again. We wound up back in Visalia, and I was 17 and a half, and it was about 2 months from finishing high school, and they were leaving town again. And I just decided that I wasn't going, made other arrangements, and by the time I was 18, I was a heroin addict. Because I wasn't going to be an alcoholic. And I'm like, and the journey went on. I was always left down, always doing the stupid stuff. Never had any true coping skills. So from that time until I was 37 years old, in varying degrees, there were good times and there were bad times. There were marriages and there were divorces. There were good jobs and no jobs and all that stuff that comes along with living, under the throes of the disease, making poor decisions about life. Going on and on and on, and always thinking that I had one more good idea. If I did this, I could straighten this mess up, that this would work this time if I did this way. The only thing that happened consistently was that I was always high. I was always high. I would always return to it. I would get sober once in a while, but I would always return to the drink. And by the time I got here, the last years of my life, I guess in 1986, I went to that Teen Challenge, and I had gotten out, and I had gotten a wonderful, wonderful job. And I was married and had a little son, and and it just wasn't enough. You know, we are irritable and discontent until we solve the problem, until we figure out what the problem is. And I was ignorant of what my problem was, and I wound up drinking again after I got out of there, and that marriage went down the tube, the job went down the tube, and I wound up wrecking a motorcycle coming out of Farmersville drunk, and wound up back on my mother and dad's couch. My dad was a wonderful man, and he had put up with me for through all those years and tried his best to help me. And he let me stay there till I could walk again and everything. And of course, once they quit giving me the pain pills, I learned to walk because the liquor store was about a mile down the road. So I could, you know, I had to learn how to walk down the liquor store. And time went on there, and one day my dad said, "Dave, get in the car, let's go for a drive." And we headed off towards Tulare, and he started talking about serious stuff, about me, you know, and my problems. And he got out there just east of Tulare, and he stopped at a stop sign, and he said, "David, this is where you have to get out. And you can't come home no more." And that began the last 4 years of my disease, where I learned an alcohol, what's that King Geolus says? Alcohol led me to believe that it was okay to live like that. And I learned how to live like that. Abandoned houses, you know, hustle and work here, hustle and work there. And my dad had always taught me skills and trades where I could make a living. I could go almost anywhere and make a living. Not a living. I could get drunk almost anywhere. I could get the bottle of the day. And but I wound up east of town here in behind a secondhand furniture store. This old retired Nazarene minister had a furniture store, and all furniture stores had used appliances, and I fixed appliances. So he allowed me to stay in this abandoned pump house in the back there and work on his appliances. And for the next 3 years, the 3 years that I stayed there, that man stood at the gatepost and did his job as God had taught him to do. And he did his best to try and point me the right direction. And by the end, it was down to where he would just keep my money for me. And he would hand me $5 in the morning, and I would go down and get my half pint and my cigarettes, and then I'd come back, and at noon he'd give me $5 more, and I'd go get my half pint and my whatever. And at night he'd give me 10, and I would get my pint, two low and brown darts, some pack of cigarettes, go back to the store, and life was good. And as the money accumulated, if I hadn't got arrested again, you know, which I did quite often, I began to think that jail was a vacation. It was a place to go get rested up and fed, pay off the fines, and get them off my back. And on my wall in my office, on September 25th of 1989, I have the, I once again was arrested. I think it was public intoxication at that point in time. That one. And but the fellow who was the trustee taking the pictures had been to jail so much that him and I were good friends. We were jail friends, you know. We were friends. I mean, I knew him from jail. Yeah. And I was too drunk to do the right, left, you know, that thing. And so he kept taking these strips of pictures. And I talked him out of one of those strips. Yeah. You know. And so I took one of those pictures and blew it up into an 8x10, and I keep it in my office so I can remember what it was like. And I had been going to drunk driving school, and a fellow member of AA had kept suggesting that when I got done doing these, I guess he could say it, when you get tired of doing this, David, he says, "I can get you some help. I will get you in there. We'll get you some help." And of course, I kept telling him I had important things to do. And he kept telling me, when you get done with all this important stuff you've got going on, he says, we'll get you some help. And one day, I had to go to court in Dinuba for another offense. And I'd already been to court in Dinuba many times. And the bailiff there knew me, and he knew I was drunk. And the last time I had been there, I was drunk and reeked of alcohol. And when I left, he says, if you ever come back in here smelling like that, I'm going to send you right back up to the judge. Because I'd walked by him to sign the paperwork. And so the next time I went, I thought, I better not do this. I better just not drink. I'll just get up there, get it done. And my court thing was supposed to be at 9 o'clock in the morning. And so I caught the bus and I went to Dinuba. Didn't drink. Figured I'd be back by noon. Everything would be okay. And they held me over to the afternoon session. And that didn't fly, And so I did my court thing and I got back on the bus. I didn't have any money. So I had to get back to Visalia to get to my liquor store where I did have credit. Because I went in there every day and gave them $20. And by 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I wasn't feeling so well. And it was showing, and I was shaking, and I was sick. But I couldn't drink when I got back to Visalia because the judge had said you go immediately back to that drunk driving school and sign up again. And so I had to go to the drunk driving school, and I'm sitting in her office waiting for them to come in, waiting for this sweet lady Debbie to come in. And she walked through the door and she just looked at me, and I was pretty rough. I think I weighed 130 pounds and my hair was falling out from malnutrition and things weren't good. My clothes were probably dirty and I know my shoes had holes in them. And she just looked at me and she cursed a little bit because she was tired of looking at me. And she just says, aren't you done yet, David? Aren't you done? And that day I was done. She took me in her little room and yelled and screamed at me and did her thing. Told me I had to go to extra meetings because I had not been to any meetings yet, and I had to go to extra. And I told her, Debbie, you know I don't have a car. Yeah. And she said, well, I think you can walk. Yeah. And she says, go back in and see Jerry. And Jerry asked me that question one more time. I can get you some help. And I was just broken enough at that moment to say, okay, sign me up. And so he did. He got me on in there to see those people, and I got on the waiting list. They have a waiting list. I need help now. This waiting list thing don't work out so good. And this must have been just before, the 2 weeks before the date that I went in, because I know that I had waited, and I had broke myself down to drinking just one half pint in the morning and one in the evening, waiting to get on the waiting list, and to get into a bed, and I had called them every day faithfully. And then that one day, the 25th, was kind of a fluke, because a friend came by. I'd already done my drinking, and I was done, locked up in the shop. And we got in the car and went somewhere, and I got arrested for public intoxication. But come the, must have been the 1st of October, that I had waited long enough, and I wasn't going to wait anymore. And so I devised a plan to put myself out of my misery and end this thing, because I wasn't going to do this anymore. I couldn't quit drinking, and I couldn't drink. Life just wasn't worth doing. So the best I could come up with, my mind works well, was to steal Art's, that old retired Nazarene minister, to steal his pickup truck, and to load up furniture out of his furniture store, and to go where I knew I could get what I needed, and enough of it to do what I needed to do. And I did it. Only thing is that when I came to, I was laying on the lawn in Cutler Park, and they were about to mow over me. And I left out the nearest arch truck with the door open, and I went up there, and all my stuff is on the seat. And so I didn't do it very well. I went over to the man, the caretaker of Cutler Park, and he knew me too, because I had mowed that lawn many times myself. And asked him to use his phone and called Art. And Art told me not to go anywhere, just to wait right there. I figured the police would show up and that would solve that problem. Yeah. And Art showed up. And there's an old man. And Cutler Park has this hill going up just by the river. And his truck was right up there on the road, and I was down there, and Art got out of his car, and I thought he was going to hurt himself, because he was coming down this hill with his paper in his hand, and saying, David, you'll never believe it, you'll never believe it. I'm like, what? You know? And he said, they've got a bed for you. And I said, well, let's go back to the shop and I'll get my clothes and stuff, because I had a paper bag with clothes in it. And he says, no, I've got all your stuff in the car. And he dropped me off at the doorstep of Pine Recovery. And the only thing I remember about checking in was a little, had a bunch of questions, but the question I remember is, are you willing to do it our way? And I think that is when I truly made the definitive decision that I would turn my life and my will over to the care of God. Because I stopped at that question, I contemplated it, and I said, okay, I'm going to surrender to this program. I'm going to do what these people tell me. Not knowing that I didn't have the ability to do that, but to the best of my ability, I made a commitment. And I did, to the best of my ability, do what those people in Pine told me to do. And then I went to meetings, and I read the book, and I learned how to get up in the morning and make my bed and go to the prayer session and to eat food. And I got to begin to watch people. There are many people in this room. I was sitting here thinking, well, you know, there's scattering of faces of people that greeted me when I got here, you know, that were here when I got here. And then there's others that have filtered in after I got here. And each and one of them I will call my friends, you know, that have watched me in recovery practice this program of Alcoholics Anonymous, because that is what we do. We practice the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what I did. And those who have been here long enough have watched me practice, and sometimes I struck out, you know, and made some poor decisions, because I, for a long time after I got here, still relied upon my thinking, and did not have the ability to properly identify and label the fears. What is love? What is surrender? What is justice? How do I attain these things? How do I alter myself? What do I do to get this? And I practiced not stealing in Pine Recovery because I smoked. And there were people in there that actually had money. They were inmates, you know. I mean, what do you call them in the house there?
Residents,
yeah. They were inmates. They had no other place to go. But they had people. They had family, and people would buy them stuff and bring it in there. And there were some of them that were just stupid enough, I guess not knowing who I was or what I was, that they would put their cigarette on the table and go in the other room. Go figure. Yeah. So what I had to do was, I had my cigarette pack. I got my cigarette pack and I made little notes, and I would slide them in the cellophane, and I had one for every day. David, you don't have to lie today. David, you don't have to steal today. And that's how I would, every time I get my cigarette pack, there would be that thing. And incrementally, I began to develop a conscience. The disease subsided, the chemicals subsided, and my awareness by reading and hearing people speak in meetings about this God and the principles of this program, the steps of this program. I began to identify those, and I began to actually want to incorporate those in my life. The honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness began to believe that I did not have the answers. And I saw people in meetings that seemed, I wasn't quite sure, but they seemed to be happy. They seemed to have jobs. The things that I always longed for and never could keep. I could always get them, but I could never keep them. And it's funny, in the big book it talks about that, you know, that our problem is our inability to form, to keep and maintain personal relationships. Because under the influence of the disease, I become a very dishonest human being. It's hard enough for me sober not to be a liar. It just is. You know, there's times when it's out of ego or not wanting to feel less than or this and that I will say something that I'll go, well, you didn't have to do that. You didn't have to embellish that, did you? You just didn't have to do it. So I practiced this program, and little by little I began to learn. I began to find out what those fears, in the fourth step, where we actually make a list of people, places, and things. And that list leads us over to the next column and the next column, and I get to find out what my part in life was and why I set myself up and allowed myself to be in position where people, when my dad dropped me off, I had words for that man. And they weren't kind. How dare he do that to me? Well, how could he do that to me? And it wasn't until I practiced this program long enough that I realized that he had to do that to me. I forced him to do that to me. And his parting words were, I will no longer let you treat my wife that way. Because he said, David, you're like a time bomb. You're a wonderful guy. You work hard. He says, and most of the time with your half point, you're great. Everything's good. He says, but it's like living with a time bomb. Might be 1 month, might be 2 months, might be 4 months, might be 6 months, but it's going to go off sooner or later. And the people standing next to you are going to get hurt. And that's just the way it is. And that's the way I was. And I got here to in recovery, and I started working the steps. And as I said, I got here, and I promised that I would, I didn't say to the best of my ability at that point in time. I made a solemn promise. I'll do whatever they tell me. And I'm in a recovery home, and I'm and they got a rule in there: no new relationships. Don't make any major changes for the first year. Let's get you straightened up, and then you can go on about making other decisions. And this is going to be really sick, because I really was. I was like 137 pounds, I think it was, and my hair was falling out from malnutrition. I had gaping holes where teeth were supposed to be, and within like 60 days, this girl decided that I was a good dick. And she had a year. By New Year's, I had broken the rule in time of no new relationship, and went to go get, she was a hairdresser, and I went to go get my hair cut. I got back late. But I had done well enough that they let me stay. They had a document to me. I'm going to tell you what they told me. They let me stay. And I wound up staying in Pine for another 3 months before I exited. Gave me the opportunity to get on my feet, gave me the opportunity to get a job. I had not worked a real job in so long, and I had to make this This is where God comes in. I had to make this resume. I had skills, I had traits, but I had no job record at all. Yeah, poor one. And so I made up the best resume that I could. It was embarrassing at best. And I had prayed, diligently prayed. I needed a job. And I was working one afternoon, putting brakes on a guy that stayed at the January house. I don't know if they still have the January house at Pioneer. And a guy was staying there, and I was putting brakes on his car for him. And he says, "Hey, what are you doing?" I called him. He says, "Well, are you looking for work?" I said, "Yeah." And he handed me a card, and he says, "You know, go over there and see if they can give you something." You know? And so I got my resume the next Monday. I got my resume in my little folder, and went over across the street where the bus goes. I knew generally where it was. And I said, "You know, bus driver asked me, where are you going?" I showed him the card. He goes, "I dropped you off at the door." Good deal. So he dropped me off, and I walked into the office. And I didn't quite concern, because for 6 months I had been going to meetings every day. Yeah. Every day. And I really did not believe I was going to stay sober if I didn't go to the noon meeting. It's just the way it was. I'd gone to the noon meeting for 6 months, and if I didn't get to go, I was probably going to get drunk. And I had prayed. Part of my prayer was that I needed to be connected. I needed to stay connected to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I walked in that building, and there was a window facing the shop in the back, and I walked in, and there was a fellow standing there, and I recognized him from meetings. The guy that had been going to meetings where I went. And the boss was sitting right over there, so I went over and I said, "I'm looking for a job. This fellow gave me your card and said you might be looking for some help." And I said, "I have my resume right here." And he just looked at me and he says, "I don't take resumes." He says, "We'll talk. If it works out, it works out. If it doesn't, it doesn't." And I pulled the desk sucker up, put it in my back pocket. And we're good. Yeah, and so we talked, and there was contingency. It was 1989-1990. It was also a drought year, and they were wondering if it was going to rain. He says, "If it doesn't rain," he says, "we'll get you here started next month." And so I left there, and at that time, the Alana Club was just right around the corner there on Bridge Street, I think, or Burke. And I walked around to the Alana Club, and I was sitting there, and they had taught me. I was a slow learner, or I needed a graph to figure it out. And they just said, "Get a piece of paper, and you write a line down the middle of it, and you put the reasons why you can do something and the reasons why you should not do something." So I was sitting in the Alana Club making my list of dropped off at the door, bus will pick me up, and all the reasons why. And one of the staff came through, was walking through there. "What are you doing, David?" "Making the list, see if I should take this job or not, you know?" And he looked at me and he just said, "Ah, shit, David." He said, "The guy's going to drop you off at the door. You don't have a car, do you?" "No." He said, "They're going to drop you off the door. He doesn't want your resume." And that's the way God works. And I found that feature more times in my recovery than not. If I allow it. If I just follow the simple rules. And I took that job, and I kept that job for the next 10 years. Wonderful job, wonderful employer. Hard job. But good for me. Good for me. And I continued to practice this program. I continue to practice to the best of my ability. That's where this comes in, to the best of my ability. Because even though I had a year or two or three or four or five or six or seven or eight and even up to 10 and 11, I was still practicing and still making some fairly, this is questionable, whether they were bad choices or were they part of nothing happens in God's world by mistake. Because that's in the book there, and that's always perplexed me a little bit, because sometimes things happen to me that I didn't think should have happened, or I wanted to blame somebody for it because it just didn't feel right. It didn't turn out like I thought it was going to turn out. And in those 10 years, I got married twice. I got divorced twice. And like I said, I don't know that they were not accidents, and they were not, I don't know what they were, but what I do know is that I did not drink through either of those situations. I didn't drink when I got caught in this, I don't know if any of you know what a lathe is, but it's a big machine, and I got caught in that thing. And it changed my life totally. That's how it ended my career at that company that I had that job in. And illnesses that came along, death of people that I loved. Things that have happened that no matter what, wife, no wife, job, no job, good health, bad health, it's in the book too there somewhere, is that I did not drink no matter what. And by not drinking, I got to experience the absolute reality of my decision making. Some of those were things that I had decided to do that people had looked me square in the face and said, David, you might want to rethink that. Maybe you don't want to do that. My sister-in-law one time looked at me and she says, David, and I was getting into that second marriage, she says, you know, if this doesn't work out, you're not going to drink, are you? Yeah. And I said, nah, I ain't going to drink. Yeah. Yeah. And I didn't, you know, but it sure was miserable getting out of there. Yeah. But it was that misery and that stuff that made me willing to actually honestly look at my motivation for why I got into it. You know, many of you here will experience that yourself. You will make decisions that are unhealthy for you and maybe unhealthy for others. But if you don't drink, you have the ability and the opportunity to learn from your mistakes. Drunk, I never learned from a mistake. One, I just found somebody to blame it on. Yeah, somebody else's fault. So, yeah, just circumstances, bad luck, whatever. Yeah. And when I got sober, I had to become accountable for my actions. I was still accountable for the actions I took when I was drunk. I paid child support to have everything I made for the next 10 years. One time this guy was in a meeting and he was bragging about paying off his child support, so I followed him out to the parking lot and said, how did you do that? He says, I paid him. One check at a time. That's how I did it. And lo and behold, that's how I did it too. That's how it worked. That's how I did my court fines. You know? I no longer had to go to jail. It was no longer acceptable to go to jail. I just gave him some money. Yeah. Alcoholics Anonymous provided me with the means, the friendship and fellowship, and the direction to be able to assimilate and observe others' actions, to be able to form a concept of a higher power. And through experience, you know, the things that happened, the coincidences that were just too strange to be coincidences, answered prayers that gave me the proof that in the spirit of goodness that lives in each one of us, if we just call on that spirit and we feed that spirit with positive, with the real stuff in life, the important stuff in life, if we just feed it and allow it to flourish, that we get to draw on it. Just as it states in the book, there's this phrase that just scared the shit out of me when I was in early recovery, and it talks about alcohol being the rapacious creditor. And I can tell you when I got here, the only thing here that was left was the disappointment that I didn't die that night. That I just didn't end it and could do that. The disappointment. And the realization that I had nothing left to do, but I had to do this. It had to work. The desperation. I hope you have it. I hope you no longer want to live that way. You never have to drink again. That's what I found out. And I remember hearing that in a meeting. A fellow said, you never have to drink again. And I was couldn't fathom that. I couldn't put it together. What do you mean? How? and it is through doing these steps, humbling yourself, becoming ignorant. Ignorant is not a bad word, I learned. It just means you don't know. It's not a bad word. It just means you don't know. And I was so ignorant, I didn't know what love was. I didn't know what justice was. I didn't know what humility was. I didn't know what ego was in real terms. Pride. All of these things. There are principles, and if you look hard enough, I'm sure you can find them all over the place. I found them actually at a convention my sponsor took me to, or maybe he gave it to me, I don't know. But it's a list of the steps and the principles associated with each one of those steps. I was kind of conflicted with God and religion and those things in my life because they had not worked for me. But I could understand the concept of a principle. The principle of being truthful, the principle of justice, of honesty, of humility, and which step is correlated will give me the opportunity to work on humility. Which step is it that will teach you humility? Which one is it? Find out. Find out what humility is and practice it in your life. It is a principle of life. A principle is a truth that never changes. It has not changed from the beginning of time. It does not change what religion you're in. It is a principle of life. It will never change. It is what it is. And if you get it down well enough, then you can start practicing. And that's what it talks about. We claim spiritual progress rather than perfection. And it is... It took me a lot of years of practicing to sort out the devastation that had happened in my life and in my spirit, to put things back in proper perspective, where I could actually deny myself something. My sponsor told me, David, what do you want? And what is it you want this time? Because I'm irritable, discontent, I get this, and I want more. What do you want, David? Okay, now, who is it going to affect if you do that or get that? Who's it going to affect? And what would God have you do? And when I ask myself those three questions, a lot of times I don't get what I want, because it might affect someone in a bad way. All of those little one-liners that we have around here. Two-liners, whatever they are, you know. Does it need to be said? Does it need to be said by me? Does it need to be said right now? Learning to deny the fact that, well, maybe my opinion isn't needed right now. Yeah. Maybe I don't need to tell or share with this person my great intellect and fact, you know, and how to do their life. I hope, for those that are here, that were here, and those who have been here long enough to be working the program and have a grasp of what's going on, I thank you so much for having been a part of my life and sharing yourself and your experiences and all of the good and the bad. It's hard to come in here after you've made a total ass out of yourself in life. And there are people in here that have watched you do it. Yeah. And people in here who have said, hey, David, maybe you don't want to do that right now. And you have to come back a year or two later just beaten, battered, and brokenhearted and going, how the hell did that happen? Why did I do that? And this fellow friend, one of my mentors, I would wind up on his couch in the middle of the night or 3 o'clock in the morning crying, going, how did I do this again? How did I do this? Why would I do this? And that's where it gets in. He says, David, you're just practicing. You're practicing. Don't worry. Don't drink. Some clarity will come to this. Maybe it was a mistake. Maybe next time you will not do it just that way. Key to it is don't drink no matter what. Give yourself a break. Feed yourself. Feed yourself with what's in this book, the 12 steps, the principles of this book, whatever spiritual concept that you have. Draw on it. Experiment with it. Be open-minded with it. and allow it to change and develop from your preconceived notions to what it can be in your life today. It will set you free. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous has given me, and it's given me the ability to, I hope and pray that I can be half the person that that old retired Nazarene minister was, standing at the gatepost, waiting to point me in the right direction, and willing, 6 months after I got sober, I go back out, because some of my junk was still there, and I walked in the office, this man's office, in the store, and he looked at me and said, "David, there's something different about you." And I said, "Oh, you got unclean clothes." And he says, no, he says, that's not it. He says, "It's in your eyes." He says, "You're not guilty anymore, are you?" Yeah. Still willing to be at the guard post after I stole his truck, stole his furniture. So I hope that you allow yourself to take 83 and 84, read them, comprehend them as best you can, and 10 years down the road, you will continue. They will continue to mean more and more and more to you. That's 83 and 84. The promises of Alcoholics Anonymous, things that will, not maybe, but will happen in your life. Give yourself a break. You never have to drink again. Thanks.